Members will call the meeting to order.
Yeah.
We could grab our seats.
You call Colleen and...
The focus, almost the entire focus of today's meeting is going to be to discuss the essential health benefits direction, hopefully, that we're hearing from CMS and HHS in Washington, the implications here in the state, and some good Q&A, hopefully, from the committee about the implications for Minnesota and Minnesota health care. So I want to thank and welcome the people who will be testifying today and encourage committee members to ask away. This is our opportunity to get more up to speed. The essential health benefits set, along with whatever comes forward in the way of an exchange in Minnesota, are going to dramatically shape health care coverage opportunities for Minnesotans. So this is a vitally important topic, glad that we were able to get this on the calendar fairly early. Our first testifier, and I want to welcome you to the committee, is Professor Amy Monahan from the University of Minnesota Law School. Professor Monahan, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and who you represent, and then feel free to proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thanks for having me here today. My name is Amy Monahan. I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, and I should also state that I did serve on the Institute of Medicine committee that advised HHS on essential health benefits. So it's a real pleasure to be here today to talk to you about this. What I'm going to do is provide just a very brief overview of the statute for those of you that might not be familiar, give you a sense of what the federal process has looked like to date, both in terms of what the Institute of Medicine recommended and recent HHS guidance on how they intend to proceed with essential health benefits. And I'll wrap up just with some thoughts about how the IOM recommendations and HHS work together and what it means from a state's perspective. And I certainly look forward to taking questions at the end of the session. So just for those of you that might not be familiar with the statute, essential health benefits comprise the core benefits that are going to have to be offered for individual and small group market plans beginning in 2014. They serve multiple policy purposes. One of the important market functions that they serve is to establish a floor of coverage below which insurers can't compete. And by that, I mean, by specifying certain essential health benefits that have to be covered, insurers aren't able to compete for the healthiest patients by stripping down their coverage in a way that only attracts healthy individuals. So part of this is really to set a standard for market competition and to prevent what we refer to as risk classification by design, being able to design policies that only attract certain risk profiles. And of course, there's also a very real impact in terms of this is going to be the coverage that many people who are new to health insurance gain beginning in 2014. One of the interesting things that we don't know is whether or to what extent the market would voluntarily provide coverage in excess of essential health benefits. So that's something that those of us that have worked on this try to keep in mind, is that we might not see insurers offer more generous benefits than essential health benefits. This may, in effect, be both the floor and the ceiling. The statute, while it says that all individual and small group policies have to cover essential health benefits, it does not define in detail what that means. Rather, it's been left to the Secretary of HHS to define within certain parameters. Very briefly, there are 10 categories of care, whereas lots of people refer to them as the 10 buckets. We've got 10 categories that have to be covered, but not every service within those needs to be covered. The scope of essential health benefits is to be equal to the scope of a typical employer plan. So there's some language in the statute about generosity of coverage. And then there are various non-discrimination provisions, making sure that coverage is available in a balanced way that doesn't disproportionately affect certain groups and so on. But other than those broad statutory guidelines, this is something that has been left to HHS to define. And that's where
And Professor, I'm going to interrupt you just a moment because I want to make it clear to people. HHS is sometimes what we refer to as Minnesota HHS. When you're referring to it, you're referring to the federal government's Health and Human Services Department.
Yes, I apologize. I am using HHS here as the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So this was a big task, and HHS commissioned a study by the Institute of Medicine. The Institute of Medicine, for those that aren't familiar, is the health and medical arm of the National Academy of Sciences, so it's an independent organization. They have a rigorous selection process and peer review process for their work. So HHS asked the Institute of Medicine to, I have the language up there, develop policy foundations, criteria, and methods for defining and updating essential health benefits. I was one of, I believe, 18 members on that committee. And what we did was work over the course of 9 months to try to reach consensus with respect to essential health benefits, which I'm happy to report we did. There was a lot of public input to that process. We held 2 public workshops where we heard from 59 speakers who had something to tell us about essential health benefits. We received many more comments through various online portals. We conducted our own independent research and analysis and held 4 multi-day in-person committee meetings. And of course, as you can imagine, many other conference calls and the like over the course of those 9 months. And at the end, we issued a consensus report to help guide HHS in its definition of essential health benefits. I should note that the committee was made up of a very diverse group of interests, and I think we were all pleased that we managed to reach consensus. What I'm going to do next is talk about some of the key issues that emerged from our perspective, and then go over some of the key recommendations that I think would be of interest to the states that are now tasked with figuring out essential health benefits. By far, the most important issue, and the one we struggled with the most, was trying to decide, or kind of trying to grapple with this issue of, on the one hand, the comprehensiveness of the benefits that are offered in an essential health benefits package, and what it means for affordability. I think everyone on the committee recognized that that was the hardest part of our task. On the one hand, you want to give people the broadest possible coverage, but to do that raises prices and increases concerns about affordability. So that was an overarching concern we had throughout the process. We also spent some time trying to figure out what typical means. The statute says the scope should be equal to a typical employer plan. We decided that that should mean a small employer. But one thing we learned through this process is that there actually isn't a huge amount of variation in terms of which benefits are offered in various markets. What differs are plan structures, like deductible levels, co-payments, networks, medical management techniques, which I'd be happy to talk more about in the Q&A. But nevertheless, we decided that given that there are many more small employers than large employers, we would go with small. Another issue that we struggled with was determining whether state mandates should in some way be grandfathered into essential health benefits. I'll talk more about our conclusion there in just a minute. And also, trying to think through whether there should be a single national definition or whether state variation might be allowable. So with that in mind, I'm going to turn now to talk about some of our key conclusions and recommendations. I do want to note that I'm highlighting ones that I decided were probably most important for the committee. There are a lot of others that deal with process and data gathering that I've omitted. So just to be clear that this isn't the full report, which, if you've seen it, is over 300 pages.
And Professor, just for clarification, you were part of the group that advised the federal Department of Human Services on the essential health benefits.
Correct. Right. Correct. Okay. I served on the IOM committee.
Very good. Thank you.
So, and here I'm stating my own personal opinion. I think one of the most important recommendations we made was that cost has to factor in somehow to the determination of essential health benefits. I have the specifics of what we recommended up here, which was that the process should start with a cost target in mind. And that cost target, we decided, should be actuarially equivalent to the average premium that would have been paid by small employers in 2014, so moving it ahead for inflation, for a comparable population with a typical benefit design. So what we were essentially trying to do was say, let's make this benefits package as rich as, but not richer than, what small employers currently offer. We characterize this, and I think it's a pretty good characterization, as a market basket approach to deciding what gets in. So we use a report in the analogy about going grocery shopping. So one approach is you go to the store and you just see what looks good and you put it in the basket and you see how much it costs when you're done. And what we're trying to suggest is that it would be better to shop with a budget, right? Go to the grocery store knowing how much you have to spend and make trade-offs within that context. And recognizing that a lot of those trade-offs are very difficult to make when we're talking about which services get in and which don't, is that there should be a role for a public deliberative process in making those trade-offs. And by that I don't simply mean a chance to comment on proposed regulations. It's a much more specific process, which is outlined in the report, that essentially uses expert facilitators to make the trade-offs very real. These are done in relatively small group settings to try to figure out what do people value in health insurance coverage? Where are their priorities? And some people do really excellent work in that area with respect to facilitating those discussions. So we wanted it to be cost-focused. We wanted a real role for the public in terms of making those trade-offs. We did also think that it was important for states to have flexibility in coming up with their own definition of essential health benefits, so that if they didn't like what the federal government wanted to do, or if they had a different and innovative approach, we thought there should be a role for that, provided that the statutory criteria were otherwise met, and that essentially the package was equivalent in value to the federal definition. And with respect to state mandates, we concluded that state mandates shouldn't receive any preferential treatment. So to get back to the market basket analogy, they wouldn't automatically get in. Things that were subject to state mandate would be evaluated on the same terms as everything else. We were really arguing that we should start from scratch in deciding what's worthy of coverage and what isn't. I have a quote from the report there. We concluded that because state mandates are not typically subject to a rigorous evidence-based review or cost analysis, which were otherwise cornerstones of our criteria with respect to what gets in and what doesn't, the committee does not believe that state-mandated benefits should receive any special treatment in the definition of essential health benefits. I'm just now going to highlight some smaller issues that we also raised in our report. One overriding theme, which I'm sure is a familiar problem to lots of people in this room, is the need for better data. That right now, we make a lot of coverage decisions in a largely uninformed manner. And that to the extent that we could both gather better data and use it, we would all be better off. We also recommended the creation of an independent advisory board to try to remove some of these decisions from the political process. So we recommended the creation of a National Benefits Advisory Council. We saw a continuing role for cost when the package is updated, instead of simply just adding on as new treatments and services look promising, to do that again within the context of a budget. And finally, That one of our stated goals was that essential health benefits become more fully evidence-based, specific, and value-promoting over time. This gets back to the first point. We can do a better job in deciding what should be covered and what shouldn't. So with that background, I'll now turn to the bulletin that was recently issued by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that tells us more about how they intend to approach essential health benefits. Our role at the IOM was advisory only. So they had free rein to either accept it or do something different. And we'll see, they did something a little bit different. They make a statement that what they're trying to do with respect to health, essential health benefits is to balance comprehensiveness, affordability, and state flexibility. And they do this, as you know, by allowing states a choice of one of four benchmark plans, which will become the model for essential health benefits. So you pick a benchmark plan, and whatever is covered by that benchmark plan becomes an essential health benefit. I know Dr. Golden is going to speak to this as well, but the choices are one of the three largest small group insurance products in the state market, one of the largest three state employee health benefit plans by enrollment, any of the largest three national federal employee health benefit plan options, or the largest insured commercial non-Medicaid HMO operating in the state. And one of the interesting things about this choice is some of these options would incorporate state mandates into your essential health benefits package and others wouldn't. So it varies by state whether state employees' health plans are subject to mandates. The national federal employees' health benefit plan would not be. So there are some options that include state mandates and others that don't. I think it's also important to note that these benchmark plans are all plans that exist in the current market. And there are certain things that are not routinely covered in the current market that are in the 10 categories of care that the statute says essential health benefits must cover. So I've highlighted some of them that are likely to be an issue. The statute says that essential health benefits will cover habilitative services. No one quite knows what that means yet, but it is not something that is covered on a standard basis under current insurance policies. So if your benchmark doesn't include these things, you have to modify your benchmark and include habilitative services. Similarly, pediatric oral and vision care are not standard offers in health insurance contracts and would need to be added. And potentially a big one with respect to cost is that mental health and substance abuse benefits are in the 10 categories of care. HHS is pretty clear, I think, in the bulletin that those have to be offered on parity with other benefits. So you pick a benchmark, and then I think it's fair to say in every state that's going to require then making the benchmark plan more generous. And of course, as you do that, one thing to keep in mind is that premiums are going to go up from their current market level rates, all else being equal. Other things to keep in mind, the statute, as you probably know, says that any state mandates that are in excess of the federal essential health benefits definition, the cost of those mandates has to be borne by the state. Now, we don't know how they're going to interpret cost, which is an open issue, but what this means is that you potentially have to factor into your choice of benchmark plan whether it includes state mandates or not, assuming you want to keep those mandates on the books. If you pick a benchmark option like a small group policy that is subject to mandates, you don't have to pay the increased cost because your definition includes those mandates. If you went with the federal employee health plan option and you wanted to keep Minnesota's existing mandates, the state would then have to budget for and pay for the increased cost associated with those mandates. It's not clear at all what HHS's long-term plan is with respect to state mandates. There's a line in the bulletin that says beginning in 2016, which is when they're going to revisit this approach to essential health benefits, they might exclude some state mandates from your essential health benefits package. So it's entirely possible if a state right now has a mandate for infertility services, you might be allowed to keep it in 2014 and 2015 and not pay any additional cost. But in 2016, HHS might say infertility mandates are out, right? They're signaling that maybe they're going to revisit some state mandates and not let them into the essential health benefits definition without a state paying the cost. So what does this mean from a state perspective, and sort of what are the key differences between what the IOM suggested and HHS's approach as outlined in the bulletin? So a key difference, of course, is that with the approach laid out by HHS in its recent bulletin, there isn't a cost constraint built in, right? In deciding what benchmark plan to choose, states can incorporate a choice that includes the mandates and not face that additional cost. But I don't envy the choice that you have, given that on the one hand it's tempting to include to pick a benchmark that includes state mandates and essentially get a federal subsidy for at least a certain part of the population on those mandates. But the countervailing consideration is cost is a real issue. And to the extent that you pick a generous benchmark, which then has to be further added to cover the 10 categories of care, you might end up making insurance unaffordable for a certain percentage of the population. So even though cost isn't an explicit criteria here, it's of course important to note that the issue of cost doesn't go away. So states, I think, have to make a fundamental decision about how high a priority they want to place on existing mandates. Right? Are existing mandates worth the additional cost that they would mean to consumers? Another thing that I think is interesting about this approach is that it actually makes it pretty hard for a state to innovate here. The IOM really envisioned a process of rethinking what gets into a health insurance package and why. This choice of four benchmarks is a choice among products that exist in the market now, and there just isn't a way to move from that. Right? There's no choice to come up with a fifth option of your own. So in that sense, states don't really have the ability to innovate here. Some other things to think about. The IOM put a relatively big premium on getting the public involved in making the hard choices that have to be made. So one thing a state probably wants to think about is whether it might find a role and what role it will find for the public to become involved in deciding where the balance is among generosity of coverage and cost. And finally, to note that, in my view, the HHS bulletin creates a lot of uncertainty for states going forward. They've told us what they plan to allow for 2014 and 2015. It isn't at all clear what will happen in 2016. So this choice may be a very temporary choice. We may see things change dramatically in 2016, which I think further complicates the task for states. It's hard to invest a lot of time in gathering data and making tough choices if it might be work that only impacts 2 years. And that concludes my remarks, and I'll be happy to take questions later in the session. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. I think, members, if you're all right with this, what we'll do probably is move to Dr. Golden's presentation, and then, you know, if you can keep a list of your questions. I know I've got three of my own, and I know Representative Huntley's in line. I think we have a couple, Representative Branson, Representative Quam. So we'll keep a list of people having questions if you want to keep those down. Then we can have a good discussion. We'll ask both Dr. Golden and the professor back to the testifying table at the end so they can both be there to help answer questions. I think that might be a good format. Dr. Golden, before we officially welcome you to committee, I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes of our January 31st meeting.
So moved.
Representative Huntley moves the minutes of January 31st. Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And we have the minutes approved from January 31st. Dr. Golden, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden. I'm the Deputy Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, what I was hoping to do today was the Department of Health and Human Services at the federal level on December 16th released a bulletin, as the professor said, that provided some insights as to where the department intended to go with regard to its regulatory guidance and provided some assistance to states in order to help them understand where things were going on the essential health benefit set and to be able to make some of the decisions. So what I'm going to do is walk through in a little bit more detail exactly what was in the bulletin, what some of the implications of that are for Minnesota, and then some of the work that we have been doing to try to understand how that relates specifically to Minnesota and some of the issues that might be facing us within the next few months. As the professor said, the Secretary of HHS was charged with defining an essential health benefit set. It was one of the major issues was it was to look like a typical employer plan. You know, when you think about a typical employer plan, most individuals get their insurance through a large employer. However, there are many more small employer plans that are offered in the market. Starting in 2014, all of the non-grandfathered individual and small group plans, both inside and outside of a health insurance exchange, as well as the Medicaid benchmark and benchmark equivalent, and a basic health plan, if a state were to have those, will be required to cover an essential health benefit set. As the professor said, there were in the ACA 10 categories of benefits that were required to be included in an essential health benefit set. I'm not going to read them to you, but obviously you can look at the slides and see the categories that are included. The first thing to understand about the bulletin that HHS released in December is that the bulletin only covered the covered services. It did not make any reference to cost-sharing issues. It did not provide any methodologies or guidance on actuarial value, nor on the concept of actuarial equivalence between plans. Similarly, it did not address the essential health benefit in the Medicaid benchmark benefits. Those benchmark benefits were part of a law that existed before the ACA in 2005. They anticipate that they will provide further guidance on how it relates to the Medicaid benchmarks. Another thing that the guidance didn't do is it didn't provide much in the way of definitions that would have been quite helpful. So, for example, throughout the bulletin, it describes things such as products and plans and enrollment. And I will talk a little bit later why some of those are significant definitions. Then it also provides a term that is substantially equal with, again, not providing any specific guidance on what that term will ultimately mean when there's formal regulations. To give a sense where some of this came from, again, there's a need to be a typical employer. Given that many people are getting it through large employers, there are lots of small employers that provide it, and public employees, HHS commissioned a number of surveys as well as looked at existing surveys. And what they found is that when you look across those markets, for the most part, the types of covered services don't really vary very much. So if you look at the range of things that are covered, there's not a lot of significance in difference there. Most of the difference is really related to cost-sharing, deductibles, and those types of issues. Again, they cover generally the same scope of services. There's really no systemic difference between the different markets. But they did point out that there are a few areas where you start to see significant variation, either in the covered services, the specific types of treatments that might be covered, or some of the limitations that might be associated with the plans. And specifically, areas that they called out were mental health, substance abuse treatment, pediatric oral and vision services, and then, as the professor mentioned, habilitative services and how those fit in. So what the bulletin proposes, or what they state that HHS will be proposing in regulations, is that each state will be asked to select a benchmark plan. And that benchmark plan would serve to help define, well, first it would serve as a reference plan. So the certificate of coverage for your benchmark is essentially the reference document for what will be the EHB benchmark. And that would reflect both the general scope of services as well as any limits in services for a typical employer plan.
Dr. Golden, just for clarification, especially for those watching this, when we talk about the essential health benefit set, and we're basically saying this is a minimum benefit set, correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. The other thing that the bulletin was quite clear about is that the choice that the state makes now between the four plan types that are available is the choice for 2014 and 2015, and that there may be a very different type of structure choices options that HHS will put forward for 2016 based on the first 2 years of experience. I want to walk through again the issues that the professor raised with regard to what the benchmark options are and be a little bit more specific as to how those relate to Minnesota. And before I go down this slide, it might be helpful to talk a little bit about some of the nomenclature that is there. So the first concept is a concept of a product. And the way to think about a product in this context is it is a family of plans. So essentially, an insurance product will generally have an identical benefit set. So the covered services are identical in the different options that you have available. But what is really different is the cost sharing. So you might have a family of plans, which is a product, and then each plan is one that has, say, a $1,000 deductible or a $2,000 deductible or a $5,000 deductible. Together, they make a product, a family, and then each one of those is a particular plan within that product. And so with that as the terminology, the first option is you look at your small group insurance market, you find your three largest products, and then within each of those three largest products, you find the largest single plan. And so any one of those three health plans can serve as a benchmark. The next option would be any of the three largest state employee health plans. Now, in Minnesota, while we have different administrators, we just have one state employee plan, CGIP, and so that would just be one option, which would be the CGIP option. The next one is any of the three largest national federal employee health benefit plans. Interestingly, again, there are really two options because one of them is the identical benefit set but simply has different cost-sharing options. And then the fourth one is, as it is stated here on the slide, it is the largest insured commercial non-Medicaid HMO operating in the state. What's a little bit interesting about that as an option is it doesn't actually get you down to a plan. And so in Minnesota, the largest HMO may not actually be the HMO that has the single largest plan in it. So it's not clear, did they mean take the largest HMO and then the largest plan within that, or did they mean take the largest plan enrollment, which might not be the same? I tend to think it's the latter, because that is how it is in the CHIP and Medicaid requirements in existing statute, which much of this was modeled after. But I do think it starts to highlight the issue of a bulletin is nice, but it doesn't have the same precision that one would expect with regulatory guidance. The other thing that the bulletin started to get to is what is the time frames and what is the default for this. So HHS will use enrollment data from the first quarter 2 years prior to the coverage year. So if you think about this, this is the essential health benefit set for 2014. So in order to think about what's your largest plans and products, you would look at enrollment data from the first quarter of 2012. You would also look at the certificates of coverage that were in effect in the first quarter of 2012. HHS is quite clear that they do intend to evaluate their entire approach that they've put out for the first 2 years and may do something different in 2016. HHS anticipated that states may be unable or unwilling to select a particular benchmark, and they also have put into place a default process. So what the default process is you would take the largest product within the state in the small group market, and then the largest plan within that product, and that would serve as your base default plan. And to the degree that it didn't cover some of the 10 mandatory categories, good example would be pediatric, dental, and vision, there is a mechanism to fill that in, which we'll talk about here in a second. One other thing that I would say, that this is another good example of, when it talks about enrollment data from the first quarter, you know, one of the questions is, how do you assign enrollment to the actual products and plans? So, for example, there's enrollment on January 1, there's enrollment on March 31st, there's an average enrollment. So there's just a lot of questions about how do you actually assign that enrollment. State-mandated benefits. In 2014 and 2015, if a state chooses a benchmark that includes state mandates, then the EHB would also include those mandates and would not be required to pay anything extra for those. A state could also select a benchmark that either didn't have all of the state benefit mandates or only some of those. And to the degree that a state selected that option, it would be required to pay for those additional state benefit mandates for any qualified health plan. That certainly would be within the exchange and may have some overlap to the outside the exchange as well. Mr. Chair, one thing I would also say on the state mandates, one of the things that we have done is we have asked all of the health plans in Minnesota to make their best faith effort at helping us to understand what their largest products are and then their largest plans within that. Based on the information that we have, we believe that there are three products of Blue Crosses that would be the three largest in the small group. Within the HMO, where there's some confusion, it could be a Health Partners product, it could be a Medica product, and then there's CGIP. The one thing that I would say about Minnesota, all of those plans, CGIP, both of the HMOs, and the three small group plans, are required currently under state law to cover all of the state benefit mandates. So within Minnesota, choosing one of those plans really provides absolutely no difference. The other thing that I would say, but I can't tell you for certain, one of the things that the bulletin goes into great length to talk about is the fact that the federal plan covers 95% of all of the state mandates across the country. It's a little bit unclear why the bulletin went to such length to describe that, because of the flexibility that is offered in the bulletin, it's not clear what the implication of that is. So it's a little bit unclear until we see the regulatory guidance on what the implications of choosing the federal plan would be, because the federal plan almost certainly covers all or almost all of the state mandates, but is not subject to the state mandates. So it's a little unclear what the implication is just from the bulletin. as you've heard, to the degree that there are missing categories from the 10 categories that are in the law, the state must fill those in, and there are mechanisms to do that. So the first mechanism is, to the degree that a state is using a default, which would be in the small group market, if you have something that's missing, if another plan in the small group market covers that, not a great case in Minnesota, but if a plan, for example, in the small group, the default didn't have a drug benefit, but another plan did in the small group, you would fill it in with that. Otherwise, there are other specific methods that fill it in, primarily through the federal options that are available. They also highlighted a couple of specific areas that are problematic that I would expect to see perhaps tweaked before we get to the final regulations from where we are at the bulletin. The first is habilitative services. One of the things that the bulletin went to some length to describe is the difference between habilitative services and rehabilitative services. Thinking about rehabilitative services as relearning a particular skill and habilitative services as learning one in the first place. What's a little bit interesting about that is it's not entirely clear that's how the private sector or a typical employer plan would think about it, and it's also not clear that that's exactly how Medicaid would generally think about that. For most of these types of services, if you think about physical therapy or some speech therapy, generally the way that these services would work is it's to get a person to either normal functioning or to their maximum functioning. So I do think that you're going to continue to see some additional thought around these. But where HHS settled in the bulletin as possible directions to go and asked for some comment would be that health plans would have to cover habilitative services on a parity with rehabilitative services. So to the degree you're offering speech therapy or physical therapy, regardless of the rationale, relearning or learning, you would have to offer those on a parity, both in type of services, amount of services, and duration. The other option that they discussed was the ability to have plans make decisions about which habilitative services, report that to HHS, and then HHS would make some evaluation of those decisions and then further define it into the future. This is an area where I think you will likely see some modifications in the near future. The other area that is quite frequently not covered in the private sector would be pediatric oral and vision. It's much more common that these might be more standalone. To the degree that those are not covered, they provided some options. The first option would be to fill them in with, in the case of dental, either the federal employees' dental and vision insurance program or the state's CHIP program, which in this case would also be our Medicaid, our MA program. That would work for dental. For vision, it would simply be the federal employees' dental and vision insurance would fill that in. With regard to mental health, one of the things that the ACA did is it brought the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act to also apply to the individual market and to the small group market. And what the bulletin clearly indicates is that they will require parity on mental health. So basically what that means is to the degree that you are providing the mental health benefits, you cannot have financial requirements or limits or treatment limits that are more restrictive than you would generally have on medical surgical benefits within the plan. In this case, the plans that are in the individual and small group market will need to cover mental health, and they will need to cover it on a parity basis. Which gets to the final slide, or near final, second to the end. One of the issues is, what is the implication of selecting a particular benchmark plan? So certainly to the degree you have state benefit mandates and they're covered, those need to be specifically covered. But the bulletin is very clear that HHS intends to require that health plans offer benefits that are substantially equal to the benefits of the benchmark plan. So, that might simply mean that they have to be actuarially equivalent. So whatever your actuarial value is in one of those 10 categories, a health plan has to offer the same amount of services, but they don't have to offer any of the particular services that are there. Part of this is to provide flexibility, to be flexible in the benefits, to be able to innovate, to be able to put together plan designs that might be more flexible for particular populations, for particular consumers. So to the degree that young people might need very different services than more elderly people, to the degree that plans might want benefits that help transition between public coverage and private coverage, that flexibility does exist. You know, a good example of how this might work would be the way that it's done in Medicare Part D, the drug benefit. The way that works is, to the degree that a benchmark plan there offers a drug in a particular category, all of the plans must offer at least one drug in that same category, though they don't have to offer the specific drug that is in the benchmark. They have quite a lot of flexibility to devise their own types of formularies. So generally speaking, Mr. Chair, that's what the bulletin said and what I think I know about it.
Thank you, Dr. Golden. And Professor Monahan, if you could come up and join Dr. Golden at the testifying table, we will get into what I hope will be a very robust question and answer. And I think we've acknowledged, too, I can probably say this, this really isn't a pro versus con issue. It's more of a trying to figure it out issue for us. There are obviously many question marks that both testifiers have identified in the direction coming from HHS in Washington, and so much more to learn about this. But one thing I would like both of you to address at some point in your comments is some of the practical implications. What does this mean for people who currently have health coverage in Minnesota? Are they going to have access to that same coverage, or will that change dramatically in 2014? Some of the practical implications of what's going to be available to people in the marketplace in the next year or two. And with that, let's go to our list. Representative Quam, you're first up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure which of the testifiers, it may be the Deputy Assistant Commissioner. Mandates vary by state. What is the average level of mandates, and how does that compare to Minnesota 64? And then is there a projection of cost adder by having a delta from the average?
Dr. Holden.
Well, I'll start with this, and perhaps the IOM looked at this a little bit more across the states. You know, when you think about some of the mandates, I think the bulletin was quite clear that they tend to break into three categories, and there's only one that applies in the case of the essential health benefit set. There are benefit mandates that say you have to cover particular services or particular treatments. There also tend to be provider mandates. For example, you have to be able to access an OBGYN without needing a referral. And then there tend to be coverage mandates. So, for example, you need to cover dependents up to age 25 or 26. And so with regard to this case, it's only the benefit mandates that are there. I don't have the exact number that Minnesota has. I believe in benefit mandates we're roughly in the 30s. And how that compares to other states, I just don't have that information available.
And I'd just add, the numbers do vary dramatically by state. So you can have a low of 2 and a high of 48. I believe last time I looked, the average was about 17 or 18 per state. There are some differences in how people count. So some states have different laws and different market segments, and those count as two mandates, even though they cover the same thing. And the other thing I'll add is that cost is very contentious. It's very difficult to figure out or to reach consensus on how much an individual mandate increases costs. I think states are getting better at doing that, but it's not always a clear-cut issue.
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, the cost does bring up the logical incongruity of tying the target premium to a typical small employer and then having all of these lists of largest plan by enrollment in this category, that category, etc. And so to me, you know, if you're looking at a cost target, you would look at what are the premiums for these plans that you're restricting us to choose from, as opposed to you know, a typical small employer, which that wasn't defined in any of the documentation I saw, you know, and I'm not sure what the federal versus the state. So it'd be nice to understand the dollar range you're looking at, the target, and how that compares with the existing plans, and is that adding in a buffer for increasing with covering the entire 10 categories. So I'd like a picture of the cost, because we all know this is the biggest driving increase in our state.
Professor Monahan and Dr. Golden, maybe you could speak to that. I had a similar question around what we're really doing is setting, if I'm getting this wrong, let me know, but it sounds to me like we are locking in the Minnesota mandated benefits right now as the minimum. That's now the floor. You'd be crazy not to accept that, because then you'd actually have to bear the cost as a state for getting up to that level, if I understood that correctly. So we're basically going to have to choose that as our minimum, and the flexibility seems a little bit hypothetical within that. But the federal government's going to pay for it all for a while. Is that guaranteed, assured? Do we know that for sure? Some of those questions about what the benefits look like and what the cost is.
I'll take a first stab at that.
Professor Monahan.
And I'm sure Dr. Golden will have some things to fill in. With respect to, you know, are you essentially locked into Minnesota's mandates? I would agree with you, except, of course, there is the possibility of repealing mandates. So if the state made a decision that it didn't want to go with one of the benchmark options that incorporates the mandates because it was concerned about costs, and I think it's wise to try to get a better handle on what that cost is and what any differences would be. But if you decided to choose the federal employee health benefits plan option, there's nothing that would prevent Minnesota from saying that its mandates won't apply and from avoiding the cost there. Right, you could do that, offer that. What we might find is that they aren't much different, though. I think that's one of the interesting pieces of data that you'd want to gather.
Dr. Golden?
Mr. Chair, maybe two things to Representative Quam's point on the typical employer issue. Of course, in Minnesota, the small group market is at 50 individuals and less. I do think that one of the things about the default plan is one way to think about the default plan that is in the bulletin is it would essentially be the most popular product that small employers are purchasing in Minnesota. So I don't know that is necessarily the most typical in cost, but it at least would be the most popular one that the small employers are purchasing, kind of by the definition that's in there, because it's only small employers are the only ones who are really able to purchase that. With regard to the locked in and flexibility, I guess it depends a little bit about where you're thinking about the flexibility. So to the degree that in Minnesota, all of the state-based options, the HMO, CGIP, and the small group, all of the ones that we believe to be the options under the bulletin do require all of this, are required currently to cover the state mandate, benefit mandates. To that degree, I don't think that there probably are significant flexibilities with regard to that in the first year or two. On the other hand, where I think that the bulletin provides tremendous flexibility is in the concept of substantially equal, which I take to also read probably actuarially equivalent. So to the degree that I need to provide services in ambulatory patient services or mental health, I believe that health plans will have tremendous flexibility under the regulations to decide exactly which services to include and to not include. And as long as it's the actuarial equivalent, I don't think that they will be locked into particular services or benefits or limits.
Thank you. Representative Kwan, before we go on, I just want to remind people who might be watching and committee members, we have a few handouts, some that have just come around. Of course, we have the presentations from our testifiers today. We have a letter dated February 8th from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce with their input on this issue. We also have a copy of a release put out by the Essential Health Benefits Coalition, which is a group of job creators, business folks and others involved in the healthcare industry that was put out nationally just a couple weeks ago. And then we have just handed out the Essential Health Benefits Bulletin that was issued, as Dr. Golden mentioned, and Professor Monahan, on December 16th of 2011. So we have those materials available to committee members. And with that, follow-up, Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Part of the concern, you had mentioned the most popular, being from outside the metro area and having had insurance inside and outside, I do know that there are plans that are not very well suited to the smaller town and greater Minnesota areas, and that therefore, if you are just grabbing the most popular, you might not have a plan that really fits some of the unique characteristics and situations of greater Minnesota, and that's part of my concern. And that's, I'm done with, you know, that's my last question.
Okay. Either one of you, who wants to go first? Dr. Golden? You looked ready. That's why I called on you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwan, understand the concern. Again, I do anticipate that regardless of which benchmark might be selected, I would anticipate that the health plans will have quite a lot of flexibility with regard to specific services, and hopefully they'll be able to find ways to market to all kind of parts of the state, whether geographic diversity or other types of diversity.
Professor Monahan, anything to add?
I agree with Dr. Golden's statement. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that we're only talking about covered services, and there are lots of other ways in which plans can and will differ in terms of the role of networks, network design, cost-sharing levels. The essential health benefits don't impact that, so even if they're covering the same services, they can actually look very different to consumers.
Hey, Representative Franson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. excuse me. Ms. Monahan, how many people are part of the IOM committee?
I believe there were 18 of us.
Okay, so 18. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. So if I understand correctly, by looking at pages 2 and 3 of your PowerPoint, the IOM committee is made up of 18 people. They got together 4 times over 9 months, did some forums, research, had some committee meetings, and then decided to figure out for 300 million Minnesotans whether there could be any variation in coverage and how cost and access to care should be balanced. So my question to you is, why would you think that 18 people could make such decisions for the rest of us, no matter how long you met, and how much research you did, and how many public forums you held?
Well,
Professor Monahan.
Our role was not to decide the specifics, but was to put together, as the slides indicate, policy foundations, criteria, and methods. We were trying to help HHS develop a framework for thinking about these issues. And the 18 people that were on the committee were people that had been dealing with these issues over the course of their careers. And it's not to say that we had all the answers, but we were people that had the relevant background and work together to try to come up with guiding documents. So we were not telling HHS what to do. We were not giving advice on specific services. We were trying to create a framework for them to think through what's important here.
Dr. Golden, anything to add? Okay. Representative Franson?
Mr. Chair. And then Ms. Monahan, on page 4 of your PowerPoint, I see that there's a plan for public deliberations about trade-offs. And it seems, well, to me, and I'm sure to some out there in the public, too, since this isn't exactly very popular, that's kind of a scary sound. Could you tell us who the public is, and what if the public decides that this isn't something that I personally want?
Well,
Professor Monahan.
I would set aside the issue of this is something that I don't personally want. I mean, I think that is a separate issue. In the context of making trade-offs about what benefits get covered and what don't, who the public is, it would be lots of different groups. The goal is to get broad representation. Again, we were not dictating specifics. We were talking about big picture principles about how these trade-offs should be made. And the goal really was, or would be, to get a very wide range of views to figure out what's important and what isn't. And there's room in that process for those that would value more narrowly defined coverage and people that would value broader coverage and everything in between. It really is meant as a much more inclusive process than whoever happens to comment on public on proposed regulations.
Mr. Chair, let me just re-clarify that question. If the public decides what I need isn't what they wanted to provide, then what?
Professor Monahan.
Right. That's always going to... So the statute is set up to require essential health benefits. There is always that problem, right? That for some people, what is defined as essential health benefits might not be what they want. And I think Congress made a choice to require certain benefits to be offered to ensure healthy functioning of the market. The health insurance market doesn't work very well if insurers can compete by offering any mix of coverage that they want.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Franson.
Thank you. And then to either one of you up there, Ms. Monahan or Mr. Golden, could you tell us the price tag on this package?
The problem is there isn't a package.
Professor Monahan.
So there isn't... I mean, Dr. Golden might know the price tag of currently offered products in that 4 benchmark series, but until one's chosen, no one can do the price calculations, I don't think.
Dr. Golden?
Mr. Chair and Representative Franson, I can't tell you. I don't know that anyone can tell you the price tag because, again, I think what the essential health benefit is about those services or categories of services that need to be covered in order to think about what the premium would be or what the cost of a policy that has that. It would be impossible to do that without thinking about the cost sharing. And I think, you see that in the market today where when you have a family of products, the entire family of products cover the identical types of services, but they might have different copays, they might have different deductibles that allow people to make decisions both about what makes sense for them financially with regard to a particular structure of copays and deductibles, or what services might make sense by choosing across different families. So I think the cost of any particular benefit set can't be described without thinking about the cost sharing that goes with it.
Dr. Golden, along those lines, one question that I've gotten asked about cost is how does this impact ERISA? How does this impact self-insured people? So you've got different plan options under ERISA protection, self-insured companies
How does that change once all of this is in place? And maybe both of you could comment on that. Dr. Golden?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm not sure exactly how it might impact the ERISA. Certainly, I don't believe that the essential health benefit would apply to the ERISA plans. However, when you look at the bulk of the 10 categories, again, other than perhaps pediatric, oral, and dental, depending on where they end up on habilitation, you know, what we have found when we look at state benefit mandates, for example, most of Minnesota's benefit mandates are covered in the large self-funded ERISA employers in Minnesota. So from that perspective, I'm not sure that there's a significant difference in practical covered benefits that are out there. And I think that's kind of what they probably saw at the IOM with regard to some of the surveys that they looked at. They didn't really see a significant difference in covered benefits between the small group and large employers, who would, of course, be traditionally self-funded under ERISA. What they tended to see a difference in was how the cost sharing between the employee and the employer worked on that.
And I agree. So the essential health benefits requirements would not directly apply to any self-insured plan or to the large group market within the state, even when they purchase insured products. And your intuition is correct. We found there isn't a lot of variation, generally speaking, between what self-insured employers voluntarily offer and what state mandates require. The difficult thing is figuring out cause and effect there, I think.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple questions, but first I have a comment, and that's on the Minnesota mandates. We had testimony in 2007-2008 from Scott Leitz and Dr. Golden that, if I remember right, there were about 10% of the cost of health care was the Minnesota mandates. But of those mandates, about half of the cost was pregnancy and newborn care, and about 25% was mental health and chemical dependency. Mm-hmm. So, and those are both required by state law anyway, or by federal law, so they won't be part of a mandate that makes Minnesota different than anybody else. And I'm sure they could get that data from us and present that again in the future. My questions are, and either one could answer it, but if we do have state mandates that raise the cost of the insurance within the exchange, it's been implied that the state must pay that. But can't we raise the premiums and have the premium pay for that?
So
Professor Monahan.
Right, the way the statute is set up, that any state mandates in excess of whatever the essential health benefits are, however they are defined, the statutory language is the state must bear that cost. So there isn't the option of simply raising premiums to cover it. Federal government's going to figure out what the cost difference is. They're going to have to tell us how they're going to do that, and then the state would have to pay that amount.
Okay, thank you. And then my other question, and I think this is for Dr. Monahan.
Representative Huntley.
Just a little background on the preventive care, which is required. In your committee, well, I looked at cost-benefit analysis of some of these things. And there's a whole bunch of, there's only four or five things in preventive medicine that actually save money. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do them. And you can get into people of Representative Gottwald's age and my age that are male. PSA exams don't save any money. It doesn't mean you shouldn't do them. But because most of the people are healthy and you do all these exams on everybody, and you find that 99% of the people are healthy, and it's that cost of doing that for the 99% that are healthy that actually benefit those that turn out to be have that particular problem. And so how did your committee of the IOM look at the dollar amount that's actually saved versus whether the procedure should be done or not done?
Professor Monahan.
So I'm so happy to be able to say that was actually a separate IOM committee that looked at preventive health services. That was, that is unique for many of the reasons that you stated. And so they had a whole separate committee that issued a report on that. So I'm afraid it's not something I can speak to.
Okay. Thank you. Very good. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Monahan and Dr. Golden, I empathize with your situation. You had an extremely difficult task to look at, and I'm sure you did the best you could. However, I have strong concerns about government-run healthcare in general and government involvement in the healthcare industry. Okay, so my first question is, so I got a couple of comments and some questions. First question is there anywhere that you know of in the United States, and we'll broaden it to the world, that this type of approach has actually reduced cost, increased access to health care, and produced better medical outcomes for the patients? Anywhere, can you quote any, to point me to anywhere where I can do some research where costs have come down, patient access has increased, and patient medical outcomes have been improved based on this model that we have here in front of us?
Which one of you wants to take that one on first? Professor Monahan.
I'm simply going to say that type of analysis lies outside of my area of expertise.
Okay. I don't know whether to accept that or not, but I will, I guess. Go ahead.
Representative Grinney, maybe Dr. Golden wants to weigh in on that one, too.
At most, Mr. Chair, that certainly doesn't sound like it would be in my full area of expertise either. Mr. Chair, I don't know.
Yeah.
Representative Grunhagen.
Hey, thank you, Chairman Galtwald. Well, I do have done, I've been involved with the healthcare industry for 30-some years. So I'll give you what my experience and repeatable objective facts are on government involvement in healthcare. And what I found is the more government involvement, the worse the results get. The higher the costs go, and the lower the good patient outcomes. And this plan is going to, in my opinion, take us even further down the road of higher costs to the citizens of the state of Minnesota, less health care, and micromanaging of the doctor and the insurance company to the detriment of the taxpayers and citizens. Let me give you an example. A doctor came from my district came to me and gave me this information last session. He gets reimbursed for an office call, $17 from Medicaid, $35 from Medicare, he's an outstate doctor, and $54 from private insurance companies. He loses money on Medicaid and Medicare, okay? Mm-hmm. Yet, Obamacare, or the Unaffordable Care Act, whichever way you want to call it, is based on Medicaid reimbursement rates, which is going to drive our hospitals into huge coalitions where local decision-making about Medicare is going to be completely removed. So the other thing is, if we look at Medicaid and Medicare nationally, we see a huge amount of waste, fraud, and abuse in these programs. Medicare alone, you're going to see about $75 billion. If we look at Medicaid and Medicare nationally, we see a huge amount of waste, fraud, and abuse in these programs. Medicare alone, you're going to see about $75 billion of waste, fraud, and abuse. In Medicaid, you're looking at about three times that much, according to the information I have. By the way, I wrote a book on it. You can read it if you want in your spare time. My point is this.
Representative Grunhagen, we probably want to focus on the essential health benefits.
Yep, that's what I'm getting.
Otherwise, if we wanted to debate the ACA, we could be at this for weeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Appreciate the comment, Chair Gottwald. My point is this. The private sector, with the credit card companies, can limit their waste, fraud, and abuse to 1%. government cannot even get their waste, fraud, and abuse under 10%, and yet they're expanding to this area of essential benefits. Can you assure me as a representative, so I can assure my constituents, that this plan is going to actually lower cost, increase access for patients, and produce better medical outcomes, or is it going to seriously damage our healthcare industry in this state and the medical device industry in this state?
I know our testifiers are brought here as expert testifiers on essential health benefits. I don't know, are either of you willing to commit to the efficacy of the ACA in general? It might be a little bit beyond the scope of...
Mr. Chair, just one final comment. My point is this. This is an unproven experiment on our healthcare industry and for our patients with no guarantee of any type of medical results, and we're supposed to just accept this nonsense, and I do believe it's nonsense, okay, from the federal government down here trusting a bunch of unelected people to decide what we should have and what we shouldn't when our country was founded on the private sector market and let private companies and individuals decide what they should and should have as far as coverage without any bunch of mandates to simply drive up the cost. That's the point. We should isolate this essential benefits with legislation and kill it or minimize it at the least, in my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, our next question comes from Representative McElfatrick, and then I have Representative Liebling, Representative Kiffmeyer, Representative Murphy, Representative Franson, and Representative Huntley. Okay, Representative McElfatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Professor Monahan. You mentioned in your presentation the National Benefits Advisory Council. I wonder if you have any insights on how that council would be created and who would determine the membership, please.
So my first comment would be that it doesn't look like that's going to happen. Right? That was something that we suggested, but the idea would be a very broad-based group that represented very diverse stakeholders, so patient advocates, doctors, people in the payer system, that would have to do a hard evidence-based review to decide whether services get covered or whether to advise them to be added to the essential health benefits package or not.
Representative McElfatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If this should happen, then, who would determine the membership?
Right.
Professor Monahan.
One of the difficult things is that this advisory council wasn't contemplated by the statute. We did suggest having not HHS pick the membership, but hopefully... GAO or one of the, I'm sorry, I think it was GAO that we suggested to try to remove it from the political process as much as possible.
Representative McElfatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're done? Okay, very good. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers, and Representative Huntley somewhat anticipated my question before, because I was wanted to ask what role evidence plays in picking these particular benefits, and I guess I heard that there's a separate committee for that, but I wonder if you can just sort of generally speak to that, because and the second part of that is sort of how cost savings are accounted for, if they are, in, you know, certain things. Like, for example, lately Representative Norton and I have been working a lot on dental issues, and so, you know, there seems to be evidence now that, you know, certain preventative dentistry in the right populations can actually save a lot of other costs. So I'm wondering, as you go through these, as we try to decide on our essential benefit set, whether there's any real accounting for evidence that certain things are really essential or save money or, you know, this is a, I know it's a tremendously complicated interplay among a lot of factors, but can you give us any guidance on that?
I can speak a little bit to the
Professor Monahan.
Status quo. This is an issue that is not unique to essential health benefits. It should be an issue that every state legislature considers when they're deciding whether, for example, to mandate a benefit. And I think it's something that both states and the federal government struggle with. Some states we've seen adopt really robust processes for trying to gather the requisite data. So California has an extensive program where they have an independent office that provides very detailed data on medical effectiveness, cost, how many people already have the coverage, public health impacts, sort of the range of data that you'd want to see when you make these decisions. And I think the bottom line is everyone acknowledges that we can do a lot better incorporating data into that process. It's something that you really don't see enough of right now.
Dr. Golden?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think that's a really good question, particularly as you start to think about things such as what the cost of additional mandates might be that wouldn't otherwise be in the essential health benefit set. There's the example you raised with regard to dental. You know, clearly there are costs to providing those services, but the real question is also where are there savings that might be in some other places. You see that also, for example, in mental health. So to the degree that you have more community interventions early on and can avoid more expensive inpatient hospitalizations, you know, really some of the questions that we've kind of wondered about is how is HHS planned to take into account not only the costs of the services that would be provided, but some of the expected savings that would come from the elimination of more intensive downstream types of activities. And at this point, with regard to the essential health benefit set, there just isn't any guidance from HHS on that specific issue.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Representative Liebling?
Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, okay. Well, that's interesting to know. And the other thing I know a lot of us probably want to respond to Representative Grunhagen, and I'm not going to take a lot of committee time except for the one comment, which is that a lot of other countries do it with government health care a lot better than we do. And, you know, I'm not totally sold that the ACA is the way to go. You know, I never have been, but I tell you, a lot of countries have government health care and they deliver services, have healthier populations, much less cost. People love those systems and wouldn't give them up for the world, including Canada, England, and lots of other places. So, you know, so
Mr. Chair,
we'll go on to the next.
I respectfully disagree.
We could have a long debate about that, and maybe that's something we'd want to do in committee sometime, but we decided to limit the scope of this hearing on the essential health benefits. So I appreciate those comments, Representative Liebling, and yours as well, Representative Grunhagen. Next in line, we have Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a little tag on there, and some of those countries that have that are now going bankrupt, so I think we have to be careful about using other countries as examples because it may take us down a road. A couple questions I have are just a couple, and then I have a comment, but if someone does have insurance at the time of this taking effect, do they get to keep that insurance in the same way, same benefits, that everything else? They have it. They want to keep it. Can they?
So if it qualifies as a grandfathered health plan, so I don't remember the date that attaches to that, but if it is health insurance that you already had, it would not be affected by the essential health benefits.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
I'm not quite sure because you said in the beginning, if it qualifies and if it's grandfathered, those are two big ifs. I'm not looking for ifs. I'm wanting certainty. I want to be able to tell my constituents, which they felt they were promised, if they have insurance at the time of this going into effect, do they get to keep it?
Right, and I appreciate the reality
Professor
of the question. It's the nature of the statute is, it's a slightly complicated answer. And since I don't have the statutory provisions in front of me, I don't want to misspeak. But there are provisions in the statute that would allow health insurance that is currently in existence to continue without having to satisfy the essential health benefits requirements.
Representative. Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think it'd be good for you if you could do that and give us those pertinent qualifiers or anything else that may be there, because this is an issue that people bring up many, many times. So I think if we can address that. Mr. Chairman, I see that maybe Dr. Golden.
Yes.
I do have another question. I just wanted to be sure to give him a chance to answer, too.
I think that's something we'd want the department to give us some assurances on. But Dr. Golden?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, perhaps just to provide a little bit more detail. So I think the answer is a little bit, it depends. And so if you have a grandfathered plan that is not subject to the essential health benefits, and to the degree that a grandfathered plan doesn't change substantially over time, you would continue to have the exact same plan that you had prior to the passage of the ACA, as long as it doesn't make some significant type of change. For those plans that don't meet that requirement, but you might have now in the individual or small group market, they would be required to meet the essential health benefit set. And so for those plans that are already meeting all of the state benefit mandates, what you would likely, I don't know exactly, but what I would expect that you would see modified is a small modification in the benefit set. So, for example, many of those would not today have your pediatric, oral, and dental. That would be some benefits that would be added to the benefit set. There may need to be some modifications around habilitation, rehabilitation, and devices. Probably the addition of benefits as opposed to taking benefits away. Whether or not that, I mean, I think that your underlying benefit set would change a little bit. And obviously you're adding benefits. I would anticipate that that would probably have an impact on the premium as well.
Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm appreciating the question because I think, you know, Minnesotans are going to want to know these answers, and I'm not holding our two testifiers completely accountable for them, but we're in the end going to need to know who gets to keep what they've already got, who needs to convert to something new, what does that new thing look like, what's cost sharing. Some of those sorts of things are going to need to get ironed out, obviously, but that's a very good question from that perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes. Matter of fact, it gives me great concern when anybody from the government says, well, it depends. It gives me great concern because it really basically says the answer is no, or it depends, but there's not an answer of yes. And so I think that gives me great concern. Another question I have is, in regards to health savings accounts, which are increasing in popularity, and how does this proposal or essential health benefits, what is the status right now in regards to health savings accounts and their future?
Dr. Golden?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I might prefer to defer to the Department of Commerce on that, but I would simply say that to the degree that you have an HSA that is in the individual or small group market, as long as it is meeting other requirements of the ACA, so for example, actuarial value, there would be a need to meet the essential health benefits. I don't know that there's anything that would otherwise prohibit those in any way.
You raise another question I wanted to get answered before we run out of time here, and that is, the Department of Commerce right now approves products for the state of Minnesota, correct?
Mr. Chair, the Department of Commerce and the Department of Health for HMOs.
In the state of Minnesota. This, the level of approval now would move what, to CMS and HHS? Or, in other words, in Washington, are they going to need to approve these plans? Or does Minnesota still retain responsibility and accountability for approving what's available in the market?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the bulletin is silent on that topic, but based on comments that have generally come out of HHS, it would still be a state responsibility as part of its insurance regulation. So just as today the various regulators at Health and Commerce have a variety of requirements that have to be satisfied, both state and federal requirements, and they look at all of those when approving a product, that would also continue presumably in the future, and this is just another requirement that an insurance carrier would have to comply with.
Professor Monahan, anything to add on that?
No. The only other thing I would say about the health savings accounts, to get back to the question, the high deductible health plan that goes along mm-hmm. with it may very well be subject to the essential health benefit requirements for the reasons stated.
And so, Mr. Chairman, if that's the case, Mr. Chairman, it basically says no HSAs, because the whole purpose of a high deductible and essential health benefits and all of the listings that I see here also seem a bit in conflict with one another. So it's like a yes but thing, or maybe or another, it depends. Well, Mr. Chairman, the one thing that I do see here, though, is that Section 302, Paragraph B of the ACA directs the Secretary of Health and Human Services to define essential health benefits. And so there's an awful lot of authority that's given to that particular person, no matter some of the other advisory things. But I remember when it was said we'd have to pass the bill to know what was in it. Now it's been passed and we still aren't quite sure. And it seems as though we're going to have to buy it, but we don't know the price. But we're supposed to believe it's cheaper and it's maybe better. And so when I read through this, and I've read through this several times, and I've listened carefully, there are so many questions, so many things that are undefined, that it's really kind of an amazing way to do this. And just in regards to even the essential health benefits, I think just that alone, and the prices and other things like that, leave so many questions. But Mr. Chairman, considering the time we have today, I'll just end my questions at this point, and hopefully maybe some other information will come.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. We have 10 minutes left. We have Representative Murphy, Lohmer, Barrett, Benson, McDonald, Franson, and Huntley in that order. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I've just got a couple of concrete questions, so a little less theory. There is a family that lives in the district I represent, and Melissa, the mom, was in to see me last week at the end of the week. They have a son named Emmett, and he is just starting kindergarten, although he is probably about 7 or 8 years old. And he has a genetic condition that has caused a lot of developmental delay for him, and he's also he's not placed on the autism spectrum, but he has a lot of behavioral and he's just got a lot of issues that require, or he's availing himself of, they are availing for him ABA services, and it's helping him make progress, right? So she's been in to talk with me on two fronts. One, she is curious to know how she can be a participant in this process as we move forward. And you've made mention of a deliberative process. I know that, you know, that's a big deliberative process, but, you know, she is concerned about what the benefits look like, and she wants to participate. So I'm looking for guidance from you, from either the professor or Dr. Golden, on how that might look. And then I have one follow-up question.
Dr. Golden?
You know, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think I have a couple of questions, and I think you also highlight a particularly challenging aspect around some of these things. So what I think is a little I think there are lots of ways to participate. So, for example, obviously there's the legislative process to the degree that the legislature has some flexibility, at least in picking a benchmark, in thinking about what to do with state benefit mandates. This is certainly one opportunity for that. Across the state agencies, in collaboration with Commerce and Health, the Department of Human Services collected public comments from the public in order to get a sense of what some feedback we could provide to HHS around this. Those are other opportunities. You know, the governor's task force, of which the chair is on, has a work group that's the access work group, where we have been inviting public comment to just try to get conversation, to get some understanding of these types of issues. Opportunities to really influence whether a particular service is offered across the board, I think is rather challenging, because I do think that the way that the bulletin is drafted, it anticipates providing quite a lot of flexibility beyond the state benefited or state benefit mandates. I think one of the other things that we have heard from a number of advocates is one of the challenges that they anticipate is that to the degree that flexibility for health plans and insurers might be quite good, because it will allow innovation, it will allow the design of plans that meet different populations, one of the significant challenges out there is, how do I know what services this plan is offering versus this plan? So to the degree that you have a family or a person who has been using services, have some sense of what works, what doesn't work, might be on particular medications, when they are shopping for plans, either today, but particularly once you have an essential health benefit, it's great that mental health and behavioral health services are offered, but if I don't know which particular services are offered and I'm not able to find out about what those are, how do I make a decision? So I think that on the one side, the flexibility is quite good because it allows the market to function and to be innovative and to move. I think the other side of that is, how do we ensure adequate transparency so people have the information that they need and are able to make the decisions that are right for them and their family? And that is another part that I think has not been very adequately fleshed out, particularly when you look at a certificate of coverage. It is reasonably thin because there's clinical criteria. There's just a lot of things that go into medical necessity and decision-making that wouldn't be self-evident from a certificate of coverage. And most people that are dealing with these situations aren't going to be digging through certificates of coverage anyway.
I might add, this is where knowledgeable agents can be very helpful in connecting people to coverage and explaining to them how one plan might be better for their needs than another one.
Amen.
Professor Monahan, anything to add? Otherwise, we'll move on to our next.
I would just echo very briefly that this was one of the problems we had in trying to figure out what is currently covered in the market, that it's actually quite hard to look at a certificate of coverage and figure that out, and that translates into real consumer difficulties.
Representative Murphy, you had a follow-up.
Mr. Chair, and I'm looking at the slides from Professor Monahan, and you made a comment about the benefit set and thinking through the benchmark, and if it's too generous, it may result in unaffordable insurance, right? So when I think about Emmett and his family and the decisions that will be made about benefits, I wonder if, so we decide, whoever we are, decide which benefits are in the essential benefit set, and something really critical to a family like Emmett's is not included, then how do those benefits get covered? What is your advice on that, and where are those costs borne? Since they're not borne by the risk pool that would be included, where do those costs go?
Professor Monahan.
So this issue is very real. When I noted that one of the things we don't know, frankly, is what the market will voluntarily offer above essential health benefits. And for a lot of people, like your constituent, this is a very real issue. Mm-hmm. We all know that not everything is getting in, that whether it's these particular facts or someone else has something that isn't covered. We don't know what the market will provide. And people can predict whether the market will or won't step in. I think it's fair to say the market's going to be different enough in 2014 that we don't know. And then the issue is, you know, what's the reality for things that there is not coverage available for on the market? Well, it's either you, as we like to say, retain the risk. You pay for it yourself, if you can. Or you have to find some other source of financing, right? Whether that's a governmental program or charity or some other means. But that that issue is very real. We just don't know exactly what its contours will be yet.
Representative Murphy? Pretty good. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has to do with, for Dr. Golden, I guess. How are the essential benefits and the health insurance exchange connected?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lohmer, they are connected, I think, in the following way. So every health plan in the individual and small group market, except for the grandfather plans, are required to have to offer the essential health benefit set. The health insurance exchange would include public programs. It would include individual market and small group market. So to the degree that those types of plans are in the exchange, they are required to cover the essential health benefit set. That's true both inside the exchange and outside of the exchange. The other thing where there is a connection is to the degree that you have a qualified health plan, which would certainly be inside the exchange and may have some aspects outside the exchange, to the degree that they are required to offer benefits that are beyond the essential health benefit set, so state mandated benefits outside of the essential health benefit, that is where the state would be required to pay for those benefits. So I think that's the nexus between the pieces.
Representative Lohmer.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I have another question. What if a person wants to save money by buying a high-deductible catastrophic policy that doesn't have these coverage requirements? Where will they find that kind of a policy?
Dr. Golden.
I guess the question would be, Mr. Chair, there is catastrophic policies that are in the ACA. Those tend to have a variety of restrictions on them with regard to age and where you can have those. There would be certainly the ability to have higher deductible policies inside the exchange or outside the exchange. They would just need to meet the actuarial value that is in the ACA. So I don't know that, I mean, the marketplace in general, I guess I would just say, I just think that the requirements that are in the ACA, I'm just not quite sure how those interact with how high of a high deductible one can have. That's all.
Representative Blumer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you mentioned age. What age is that?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lohmer, the catastrophics go up to age 30. The two catastrophic plans that are described specifically by that name in the ACA is age 30.
So you can't purchase it, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, you can't purchase it after age 30, is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lohmer, not the plans that are specifically described in the ACA as the catastrophic. That doesn't mean that you can't have high deductibles within the limits of the deductibles that are in the ACA.
Okay, Representative Barrett, you get the last question. We will have to wrap this up in just about 45 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, go ahead. Ask your question.
So I'm trying to simplify a pretty complex area. And I'm simplifying it to the extent of we have health care and we have the cost of health care. So my question is related to the cost of health care. Has the department created anything in writing or an estimate, anything that you could share with us now or in the future, immediate future, about how many more people we're going to be providing services to at public expense and what the cost of that would be, and then what the savings are expected to be for those people we currently care for, and then what that net number would be? As we look to budgets in the future, obviously we as lawmakers want to understand that number, how much it's going to increase or decrease the cost of health care, given the fact we're going to be serving many more people. Do you have anything in that like that in writing that you could share?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, I don't have that information off the top of my head. Certainly, the Department of Commerce has been working with an actuary, Bella Gorman and John Gruber, to look at certainly the first part of that question about the number of people who would be covered as a result of health reform, and where and how they would be covered, whether it's the large group market, the small group market, individual public programs. So they certainly have information about the numbers of people that would be there. And, you know, I would really defer, Mr. Chair, to April Todd Malmov or others who would probably be able to present that in a much better way than I can today.
And members, that leads us to a good point. If you have additional questions that either come to you after this meeting or that you didn't get to ask during the meeting, and I'd offer the same to the public, if you want to forward those questions to the committee, we will get them to the department or others to try to get answers back, because I think there are a lot of questions. I want to thank our testifiers who handled some very tough questions for which there, frankly, aren't always clear answers right now, and thank you both for being here today. I'll remind the committee that we are meeting again Tuesday, February 14th. There will be a joint Health and Human Services Finance and Reform Committee meeting from 12:30 to 4 p.m. to discuss HMO and state public program transparency and rate setting. So again, that'll be Tuesday, February 14th, 12:30 to 4 p.m. With that, members, we stand adjourned.